Welcome to Love's Tender Flame. Tales of Romance. I'm Mardell. Reading Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Dorr Miller. Chapter 10. After the departure of the ladies, Tucker and Crane stood an instant in silence on the piazza. Solon, who had been waked from his customary afternoon nap by the frantic summons of Mrs. Falconer, was still a little confused as to all that had happened, and had gathered nothing clearly except that Burton was in some way very much to be blamed. "It's too bad," he observed, "to have them go off like that. We shall miss them, I fear." Crane was standing with his hands in his pockets, watching the taillight as it disappeared down the drive. "Let us avoid that, Tuck, by going away ourselves."
"You mean to leave here?"
"Why not? The experiment has not struck me as a very happy one. Our servants have gone, our guests have left us, and for my part I am eager to be off as well." The time had come, then, when Jane Ellen was to be friendless and out of a job. The third act was here.
"Anything that suits you pleases me, Burton," said Tucker.
"In that case," answered Crane, "I will telephone Reed to come over at once and make arrangements for giving up the house. We can't, I suppose, catch that night train, but with luck we may get away tomorrow morning."
"You seem in a great hurry."
"I'd like never to see the place again," returned Burton. In the moment of silence that followed this heartfelt exclamation, a figure came briskly around the corner of the piazza, a figure discernible in the light shed by the front door.
"Oh, come here," said Crane.
The figure betrayed no sign of having heard, unless a slight accentuation in its limp might be so interpreted.
"What's your name?" shouted Burton.
The old man looked up.
"Yes, yes," he said in a high, shaking voice. "I'm lame. You're right there, sir. I've been lame these 20 years. Carrying down all them trunks has put such a crick in my back as never was."
"I asked you your name," repeated his employer.
"When I came, why, this afternoon, sir, it was your butler engaged me. I worked at the hotel here once, and Mr. Smithfield, he come to my wife and says, 'Susan,' he says, 'he be knowing her since he was a little boy.'"
"Let me look at you," said Crane sternly. But the elderly man, still talking to himself, retreated into the shadow. And then Tucker was surprised to hear his host exclaim with violence,
"By Jove, the young devil!"
and to see him hurl himself off the piazza at its highest point. He would have landed actually on top of his decrepit servitor had not the old man developed an activity utterly unsuspected by Tucker, which enabled him to get away down the avenue with a speed that Crane could not surpass. "Well, well, what are we coming to?" Tucker murmured as he watched them dodge and double around trees and bushes. Presently they passed out of the light from the house, and only the sound of their feet beating on the hard avenue indicated that the fugitive had taken to the open. Solon was still peering nervously into the dark when at last his host returned. Crane was breathing hard and held in his hand a small furry object that Tucker made out gradually to be a neat gray wig.
"Ah," said Burton, still panting and slapping his side, "I haven't run so hard since I was in college. But I should have got him if it hadn't been for his superior knowledge of the ground."
"My dear Burton," said Tucker crossly, "what in the world have you been doing?"
"What have I been doing? I've been trying to catch that wretched boy Brindlebury. But it's as well I didn't, I dare say. I thought his limp a little spectacular this afternoon when the trunks were being carried down, but his deafness. The young fool. That deafness never found anywhere but on the comic stage was too much for me. He runs fast, I'll say that for him. He led me through a bramble hedge, back through himself. That's when I got his wig. I should not be surprised if we were all murdered in our beds, said Tucker. That's right, Tuck, said Crane. Look on the cheerful side. Come with me now while I speak to Smithfield. I want to know what he has to say for himself. Smithfield, looking particularly elegant in his shirt sleeves, a costume which shows off a slim figure to great advantage, was rather languidly setting the dinner table for two. That is to say, he was rubbing a wine glass, shaped like a miniature New England elm tree, to remove the faint imprint of his own fingers. Smithfield, said Crane briskly, I'm afraid your new useful man isn't going to be very useful. He seems to me too old. Smithfield placed the glass deliberately upon the table. He's not so old as he appears, sir, he answered. Only 66, his next birthday. A married man? No, sir, a widower of many years. His wife died when her first baby was born. That's Mr. Crosslet Billington's present chauffeur. That's how I happened to get the old fellow. And when the rheumatism... Smithfield, said Crane, that's about enough. Put down that glass, put on your coat and hat, and get out. You're lying to me, and you've been lying to me from the beginning. Don't stay to pack your things. You can settle all that with Mr. Reed tomorrow. Get out of my house, and don't let me see you again. And, he added, throwing the gray wig into his hands, there's a souvenir for you. Smithfield, without the least change of expression, caught the wig, bowed, and withdrew. And now, Tuck, Crane added, turning to his lawyer, I wish you would go and telephone Reed to come here at once and clear this whole thing up. Tell him I'll send the motor for him as soon as it comes back. It's dinner time now, observed Tucker. Ask him to dine then, said Crane. I must go and see that Smithfield really gets out of this house. Both tasks had been accomplished when, at about 8 o'clock, Tucker and Crane again met in the hall. Smithfield had actually been seen off the place. Tucker had telephoned Reed and dispatched the motor for him, and now the sound of an approaching car was heard. That can't be Reed yet, said Tucker. There hasn't been time. Crane shook his head. It isn't the sound of my engine either, he answered. Headlights came sweeping up the drive, and a few minutes later Lefferts in full evening dress entered the house. I'm afraid I'm a little bit late, he said, but I missed a turn. For an instant Crane regarded him blankly. Then he remembered that once ages before, or perhaps no earlier than that very afternoon, he had invited Lefferts to dinner. And at the same time he realized what had not heretofore occurred to him, that there was no one in the house to serve dinner, except Jane Ellen, who had in all probability cooked dinner for only two. Reed might be there at any minute. It was really necessary, in so acute a domestic crisis, to put pride in his pocket and go downstairs and speak to his cook. He put his hand on Lefferts' shoulder. "Awfully sorry, my dear fellow," he said, "that things are not quite as anticipated. Tucker will tell you we have had a rather stormy afternoon. Give him his cigarette and a cocktail, Tuck, and I'll be back in a minute." He disappeared down the kitchen stairs. With what different feelings, he said to himself, did he now descend those stairs. But when he was actually in the kitchen, when Willoughby was once again bounding forward to greet him, and Jane Ellen was allowing herself that slow, curved smile of hers, he was surprised and disappointed to find that his feelings were, after all, much the same as before. Over his manner, however, he was still master, and that was cold and formal,
in the extreme. "I wanted to speak to you, Jane Ellen," he began, but she interrupted. "This time," she said gaily, "I know what it is that you are going to scold about." "I am not going to scold." She laughed. "Well, that's a wonder." And glancing at him, she was astonished to find no answering smile. "Are you really angry at me?" she asked. "On account of this afternoon?"
"This afternoon?"
"On account of that silly plan about Brindlebury. I did not know they were going to do it, and when it was done, I couldn't betray them, could I?" Prey made a gesture that seemed to indicate that he really had no means of judging what his cook might or might not do.
"You believe me, don't you?"
"Believe you?" said Crane. "I haven't considered the question one way or the other."
"Why, Mr. Crane," said Jane Ellen, "whatever has come over you, you should speak like that."
"This has come over me," answered Crane, "that I came down here in a hurry to give some orders and not to discuss the question of veracity." The figure of Jane Ellen stiffened. She clasped her hands behind her back.
"And what are your orders?" she said in a tone of direful monotony.
Crane, as has been stated, was no coward, and even if he had been, anger would have lent him courage. "There are two gentlemen coming to dine, four in all." And as he saw Jane Ellen slightly beck her head at this, he added recklessly, "As Smithfield is gone, you will have to serve dinner as well as cook it."
"No," replied the cook. "No, indeed, certainly not. I was engaged to cook, and I will cook to the very best of my abilities. But I was not engaged to be a maid of all work."
"You were engaged to do as you're told."
"There you are mistaken.
Jane Ellen, you will serve dinner."
"Mr. Crane, I will not."
The problem of the irresistible force and the immovable body seemed about to be demonstrated. They looked at each other steadily and hostilely in the eyes. "We seem," said Crane, "to be dealing with the eternal problem between employer and employee. You're not lazy. The work before you is nothing, but you deliberately choose to stand on your rights on a purely technical point."
"I do nothing of the kind."
"What are you doing, then?"
"I'm making myself just as disagreeable as I can," answered Jane Ellen. "Of course, I should have been delighted to do anything for anyone who asked me politely. But when a man comes into my kitchen and talks about giving orders and my doing as I'm told and serving dinner while my answer is, he ought to have thought of his extra guests before he dismissed my brothers."
"Your brothers?" cried Crane. "Do you mean to say that Smithfield is your brother too?"
"Well, I didn't mean to tell you," said the cook crossly, "but it happens to be true."
From the point of view of the irresistible force, the problem was now completely resolved.
"Oh, Jane Ellen," he cried, "why in the world didn't you tell me so before?" "I can't see what it has to do with things."
"It has everything," he answered. "It makes me see how wrong I have been, how rude. It makes me want to apologize for everything I have said since I came into the kitchen. It makes me ask you most humbly if you won't help me out in the ridiculous situation in which I find myself."
"But I don't see why Smithfield's being..."
"It would take a long time to explain," answered Burton, "although I assure you it can and shall be done. Perhaps this evening, after these tiresome men have gone, you will just give me a few minutes. In the meantime, just let me say that I was angry at you, however wrongly, when I came down."
"I'm not sure, but that I'm still angry at you," said the cook.
But she smiled as she said it. "You have every right to be, and no reason," he returned. "And are you going to be an angel and serve dinner?"
"I said I would, if asked politely. Though how in the world I shall sit still and let you wait on me, I don't see.
Oh, said Jane Ellen, if you never have anything harder to do than that.
You are very different from most of your sex, and now, she added, I'd better run upstairs and put two more places at the table, for it's dinner time already.
If I come back later in the evening, you won't turn me out of the kitchen.
She was already on her way upstairs, but she turned with a smile.
It's your kitchen, sir, she said.
Crane followed her slowly. It occurred to him that he must have a talk with Lefferts. He found him and Tucker making rather heavy weather of conversation in the drawing-room. Tucker had naturally enough determined to adopt Mrs. Falconer's views of Lefferts. He had conformed with Crane's request and given the poet a cigarette and a cocktail, but he had attempted no explanation beyond an unsatisfactory statement that the ladies had been called away unexpectedly.
Nothing serious, I hope, Lefferts had said.
I hope not, Tucker had returned, and not another word would he utter on the subject.
Lefferts was therefore glad to respond to Crane's invitation to come into the office for a few minutes and leave Tucker to the contemplation of his own loyalty. Left alone, Tucker's eager ears soon detected the sound of dishes in the dining room, and he knew that this could be produced by the hand of no other than Jane Ellen. The moment seemed to have been especially designed for his purpose, and he decided to take advantage of it. Jane Ellen was setting the table with far more energy than Smithfield had displayed. In fact, her task was almost finished when Tucker entered and, advancing to the mantelpiece, leaned his elbow on the shelf and smiled down upon her benevolently.
The time has come, sooner than we anticipated, when I can be of assistance to you, Jane Ellen, he said.
Yes, indeed, sir, she returned with a promptness that 15 years before would have made his heart beat faster.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
The finger bowls, sir, she interrupted, flicking a napkin in their direction. They ought to be filled, not too full, sir. That's quite enough. It isn't a tub, you know. And now, if you've a match about you, and gentlemen always have matches, I believe, would you light the candles? And then, yes, I do think we're about ready now.
Tucker, who could not very well refuse such trivial services when he was offering one much more momentous, poured a little water from the ice pitcher into the glass finger bowls, but he did it with such dignity and from such a height that he spilled much of it over the doilies. The cook did not reprove him directly, but she changed the doily with a manner that seemed to suggest that another time she would do the job herself. And when Tucker took a neat gold matchbox from his pocket and prepared to light the candle, she coolly took the whole thing out of his hands, remarking that he might set the shades on fire, and then they'd be in what she described as a nice way. Observing that she was about to leave the room, he put himself before the door.
I want just a word, Jane Ellen.
No time now, sir. Perhaps tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow will be too late. You must know this evening. I don't want to say a word against Mr. Crane. Young men who have always had everything they want are naturally thoughtless. But I can't bear to see you turned out at a moment's notice.
Turned out?
Yes, Mr. Crane is either going tonight or tomorrow morning, didn't he tell you?
He had her attention now. She looked at him intently.
Mr. Crane, going? I thought he had the house for 6 weeks.
So he had, but he's bored with it. Miss Falconer is gone, and he sees no reason for staying on. He'll be off either at midnight or in the morning. You're about to lose your place, Jane Ellen.
She stood staring before her so blankly that it grieved him to see her so deeply concerned about the loss of her position, and he pressed on.
I can't bear to think of your comfort being dependent on the caprices of Crane or anyone. Come to me, Jane Ellen. This is no life for you with your youth and beauty and charm. I could offer you a position that you need never leave, never, unless you wanted to.
Please move from the door, sir.
Not until you've heard me. And he moved toward her as if to take her in his arms.
At some previous period of time, the Reveilles, presided over by a less elegant functionary than Smithfield, must have been in the habit of summoning the family to meals by means of a large Japanese gong that now stood neglected in a corner. To this Jane Ellen sprang and beat it with a vigor that made the house resound. The next instant Crane burst into the room.
"What's the matter?" he exclaimed, and added, fixing his eyes on his lawyer. "What the deuce are you doing here, Tuck?"
"I," said Tucker, "was giving Jane Ellen what help I could in setting the table."
"Like hell you were."
"Do you mean you doubt what I say?"
"You bet I do."
"And may I ask what you think I was doing?" asked Tucker. "I think you were making love to the cook."
"Gentlemen, gentlemen," murmured the cook, "won't you please let me go down and attend to the dinner? The chicken will be terribly overdone." Nobody paid any attention to the request.
"Well," said Tucker, "I certainly wouldn't turn a poor girl out at a few hours' notice, as you mean to do."
"Who says I mean to? You told me yourself you meant to leave tomorrow. And what kind of a job were you offering her?"
"I told you I was trying to help her."
"And is that why she rang the gong?"
"She rang, presumably, because dinner was ready."
"There's another presumption that seems to me more probable."
"Burton, I shall not spend another night under your roof."
I had reached the same conclusion. Tucker turned with great dignity.
"The trouble is," he said, "that you have not the faintest idea of the conduct of a gentleman."
And with this he walked slowly from the room.
The cook did not now seem so eager to get back to the kitchen. She stood twisting a napkin in her hands and looking at the floor, not unaware, however, that her employer was looking at her. "The trouble really is, Jane Ellen," he said gently, "that you are too intolerably lovely."
"Oh, sir."
"Oh, sir, oh, sir, you say that as if every man you knew had not been saying the same thing to you for the last 5 years." Jane Ellen had another of her attacks of dangerous candor.
"Well, a good many have said it, sir," she whispered, "but it never sounded to me as it did when you said it."
After this, she had the grace to dart through the door and downstairs so fast that he could hear her little heels clatter on each step as she went. In the hall, he found Tucker standing under a lamp, studying a timetable with glasses set very far down his nose. Opposite, Lefferts was leaning against the wall, his arms folded, and the expression on his face of one who has happened unexpectedly upon a very good moving picture show. Seeing Crane, Tucker folded up his timetable and removed his glasses.
"Your other guest has just arrived," he observed.
"Oh, is Reed here?"
"Yes," said Lefferts. "He's in your office, taking off his coat."
"And you may be interested to know," added Tucker with a biting simplicity that had impressed many juries in its time, "you may be interested to know that he is the man I found kissing Jane Ellen last week."
"What, Reed?"
cried Crane with a gesture that might have been interpreted as ferocious. Hearing his name called, Reed came hurrying out.
"Yes," he said, advancing with outstretched hand. "Here I am. Sorry to be late, but I was ready before."
"We'll go in to dinner," said Crane shortly.
Tucker and Reed moved first toward the dining room. Lefferts drew his host aside. "Just one moment," he said. "You went off so quickly. When that gong rang,
that I did not have any chance to tell you how I feel about your generosity. It makes... Crane grasped his hand. You have an opportunity this very moment, he replied, to repay me for anything I have ever done or may do for you. Talk, my dear fellow, talk at dinner. Do nothing but talk. Otherwise, I shall knock those two men's heads together.
Leffert smiled. I doubt you'd get much sense into them, even if you did, he murmured.
No, answered Burton, but I should have a great deal of enjoyment in doing it.
Join me next time for another romantic chapter of Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.